Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Has Florida reached a tipping point in testing students? Some school districts and parents say yes.
It is a daunting effort, and I don't think anyone can honestly say where they're going to be at the end of the path here.
Also this week, one lawmaker says Florida's utility companies aren't just hurting citizens, but also the state's business climate.
A small business cannot even begin to get in business when you have those kind of burdens put on you. And it's difficult to stay in business or expand your business if those are the kind of burdens placed on you.
We'll also chat with a former lieutenant governor of Florida whose new book on the experience paints a less than glowing picture of Governor Scott and his administration. And we'll find out what new Florida laws we have to obey as of October 1st. I'm Tom Flanagan. Welcome to Capitol Report. There were parents and perhaps even some school administrators and teachers who believed the end of the FCAT, Florida Comprehensive Assessment Test, would mean fewer standardized tests. But now Florida school district officials are writing thousands of new exams to administer to students this school year. Len Hatter reports the effort to create end-of-course tests in subjects not evaluated at the state level is causing more parents and local education officials to call for a timeout on testing.
Tallahassee mom Elizabeth Overholt is fed up.
It's a complete mess to start with.
Overholt is part of a growing movement of parents across the state pushing back against standardized testing. She heads the Facebook group Opt Out Leon County and is part of the district's advisory board. This year, she's trying to opt her three children out of all exams administered or mandated by the state. That includes the new Florida assessment test, which has replaced the FCAT. Overholt also doesn't want her kids taking the end-of-course exams districts now have to administer in all grades and in all subjects. One of her high school-aged daughters will end up being tested twice in one class as a result of the exam mandates.
Why? Why test her twice on the same information? That doesn't benefit her, and it does not inform instruction. If a test informs instruction, I'm okay with it. But the end-of-course exam is not going to inform instruction for my daughter.
That could be happening because the advanced placement scores won't be back until the fall, and the district would still need a way to measure how well a teacher performed. The AP U.S. History class comes with an exam that can be taken to earn college credit, but history is also one of the classes the state has created a standardized test for. But there are subjects not tested by the state that districts have to come up with an exam for, as mandated by a 2011 teacher merit pay law, which bases part of a teacher's evaluation on student learning data. The push for more exams has led districts to start creating thousands of new additional tests that are going into effect this year. And in Leon County, says testing director Jillian Gregory, the number is between 1,200 and 1,300 new assessments.
Think about all the different variations of PE there are. So physical education has, you know, advanced aerobics, beginning aerobics, intermediate aerobics, beginning weightlifting, intermediate weightlifting, advanced weightlifting. Those two courses that I've just spoken about require six assessments because each one of those courses has its own course code identification with its own set of standards and expectations.
According to media reports, Palm Beach County is facing 400 new tests. Broward County is looking at 800. At the most recent State Board of Education meeting, Hillsborough County Superintendent Mary Ellen Elia, a fixture at such hearings, voiced her concerns about what districts are facing this year.
Districts are having to fully implement Florida state standards across all grades and subjects, administer the Florida standards assessment, implement local assessments, end-of-course exams.
Her list of complaints include a new grading system, new salary schedules for teachers, a push for more technology in the classroom, and a lack of capacity to administer all the new exams on computer. There are also increasing requests by parents to opt their kids out of state testing and confusion as how to respond to those requests. But not everyone believes the situation is that dire. While state law has mandated end-of-course assessments in every class a student takes, the Florida Department of Education says it's not that different from what schools are already doing, given many teachers already administer final exams. In a statement, the department says districts don't have to make up brand new tests. Teachers and principals are allowed to choose their own. And end-of-course exams can take many forms. They could be portfolios of a student's work in a class like art, a fitness test for physical education, or if it's a music class, it could be playing scales. Industry certifications can serve as end-of-course exams in those areas as well. But as the Leon County School District's Gregory points out, the option that lets teachers choose and principals approve assessments could create a perverse incentive. For example, there's nothing in state law that says a test can't be given open book.
For that reason, districts are very concerned because the districts, essentially the state has shifted to the district level the responsibility of this test development. And then ultimately, the district becomes the face of any problems with that assessment.
Still, the idea of so many new tests and rules is daunting to both education officials and parents. And Tallahassee mom Elizabeth Overholt says she is over it.
Opt your kid out. Let's stop this crazy testing scheme.
Recently, the Lee County School Board opted out, then opted back into the state's accountability system. An Alachua County teacher grabbed headlines for refusing to administer a kindergarten test. Florida law is vague about what happens if students don't take the end-of-course exams at the district level, but refusing to take state-mandated tests is another issue. The state's third-grade reading exam, Algebra 1 end-of-course test, and English Language Arts Florida assessment are mandatory for graduation and promotion. If students don't take or can't earn a passing score on the tests, a high enough college entry exam score, or in the case of third grade, a portfolio, could substitute. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
A handful of lawmakers have announced plans to file bills to bridle what some are calling overreaching utilities. Regan McCarthy reports the measures put new rules in place for everything from when utilities can increase rates to who can lobby the utilities regulators.
If Florida wants to be a business-friendly state, it needs to extend that effort to utilities. That's according to South Pasadena State Republican Representative Kathleen Peters.
I believe that the state of Florida over the last several years has worked too hard to make this a business-friendly state and to have our utilities then increasing the deposit required to have power, which is what's critical to have a business operate, just flies in the face of what we've been working so hard for the last several years.
Peter says utility companies are requiring corporate deposits that could shut the door on small businesses before they even get their lights on. And she says it could make it nearly impossible for more established businesses to expand.
For one business, for example, Sonny's, they had a $7,000 requirement for deposit and then got notice that the deposit had to be increased to $24,000.
Peters has announced plans to file a bill aimed at tackling that issue. She and Clearwater Republican Senator Jack Latvala are working out the details of a draft bill for the 2015 session that strives to rein in utilities. The bill includes a provision that would require those lobbying the Public Service Commission, which regulates utilities, to register, and another that would stop utility companies from changing a customer's bill by extending the billing cycle. Peters and Latvala aren't the only ones with that idea. Inverness Republican Senator Charlie Dean says he also plans to file a bill to address that last issue. The measure is in response to a recent incident involving Duke Energy. When Duke changed the routes their meter readers take in an effort to increase efficiency, it also extended the billing period, bumping customers into a higher usage bracket, meaning they'd start paying more per unit of electricity. Meanwhile, Duke says it has addressed that issue and is refunding customers who were impacted by the change. But spokeswoman Nicole LeBeau says the company isn't ready to say much about the proposed legislation.
What I'll say is, as soon as legislation gets filed, we'll be happy to review it.
Peters says the proposed bills are a reaction to an electrified electorate.
It is a very loud outcry, and we represent We represent the citizens, and the citizens have made it very, very clear that they are being treated unfair. They're fed up with it, they're tired of it, and they expect it to be done. We represent them, and that's our job, is to protect them and represent them.
And Tallahassee Democratic Representative Michelle Raywinkle-Vasalinda says it's that same energized voter base that gives her hope a bill she's filing to repeal the state's nuclear cost recovery clause will pass this year.
I have filed that bill every year since 2011. So 2011, 12, 13, 14, 15, I guess this will be the fifth year.
The nuclear cost recovery clause has allowed utility companies in Florida to charge citizens for some nuclear power projects that will never be completed. After an outcry, lawmakers worked to tone down the clause some, and the Public Service Commission recently demanded one power company return some money from a nuclear project to its citizens. But Raywinkle-Vasalinda says more needs to be done.
And I think we need to make sure that the people are satisfied, that they're being treated fairly, and that no one is making a profit off of them without them getting a return on their money and their investment.
Peters and Raywinkle-Vasalinda both say they look forward to working with other lawmakers on energy bills this coming session and are hoping for bipartisan support. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Still to come on Capitol Report, we'll hear Governor Rick Scott's former second-in-command talk about her tell-all book, which touches on her time in politics, including her forced resignation.
Removing me as if I didn't even exist, I didn't run on a ticket with him, that I was irrelevant to the office, made me feel like an unwanted stepchild.
Nearly three dozen new Florida laws took effect this week.
There's no statute of limitations on these types of crimes, so no matter how long ago you were victimized in Florida, your abuser can now be punished and you can be compensated potentially.
A new president for Florida A&M University officially takes the reins. And we'll visit a college that prepares its students not only academically, but also technically for the jobs of the future.
See that everything's going to run? Then you can go ahead and hit the go button.
Florida's first lieutenant governor under Governor Rick Scott says she wants to set the record straight about certain things that occurred during her time with the Scott administration. As Sasha Cordner reports, it's all part of Jennifer Carroll's autobiography, released last month, that she's now promoting across the state.
In Carroll's book, When You Get There, the Trinidadian native writes about different parts of her life.
As far as being an immigrant, being an adopted child, going into a non-traditional work environment in the military, the challenges that I faced there, going into politics and challenges that I faced there also in a male-dominated work environment, and how I was able to utilize my faith and my strength in God to overcome these barriers and challenges that came my way.
And she says she hopes readers can use her story as a source of strength for how to overcome adversities in their life as she did. For example, she says after working for the Scott administration for a while, she began to feel like a, quote, unwanted stepchild, having to answer to Scott's staff rather than Scott himself. She says even the rare direct contact with the governor was unproductive, but Carroll says it wasn't always that way.
At the onset, I was included to be at the table when staff meetings occurred. The governor appeared to welcome my input. But as his chief of staff became more entrenched with him and in power with him, they removed me from being at the table. They removed my input. So I was getting information second and third hand to know what was going on in the administration.
She believes even when she was Scott's running mate, his campaign staff was already looking to undermine her and not run with her ideas, like trying to reach out to black voters. Still, she decided to do some outreach on her own, and she says she helped garner 6% of the African-American vote for Scott.
So when it came time for the campaign, you say, well, did it make a difference? Heck yeah, we won by 1.2% of the votes. Had I not made that extra outreach, which we got Democrat voters, minority Democrat voters, to vote for the Scott Carroll ticket, those voters, if I didn't make that extra effort, would not have voted for Scott Carroll, and we would have not have won.
She says that's part of the reason she was hurt when she was forced to step down. On May 13th of last year, Governor Scott announced Carroll's resignation amid reports she was linked to a veterans charity accused of being in a illegal gambling ring.
Lieutenant Governor Jennifer Carroll consulted for this company in 2009 and 2010 when she was serving in the Florida House of Representatives. FDLE interviewed Lieutenant Governor Carroll yesterday related to her work for this company. Yesterday, Lieutenant Governor Carroll resigned in an effort to keep her former affiliation with the company from distracting from our efforts to help make sure we do the right thing for Florida families. And she did the right thing for the state and for her family.
Carroll was never found guilty of any wrongdoing, and she feels she deserves an apology from Governor Scott.
For knee-jerk reaction and accusing me in his press release of something that I did not do, which was very disheartening and very, very hurtful to get this level of betrayal I felt from him, particularly since I helped you get elected, I supported you while you were in office, I watched your back every step of the way, I never let anyone demoralize you and demean you, I stood up and protected and defended you, but yet still in the moment that I needed your support and level of protection, you were not there.
She says instead of Scott telling her himself, she was told by his, quote, underlings, and it would have been better if he'd had a press conference standing side by side with her.
We both could have been at the podium and shared with the public why I was leaving, why I was resigning, why he asked me to resign. This would have been a better optics and truthfulness to the voters, but it was a standing order with his communications people that I was not allowed to defend myself while I was in office. So I was a little punching bag.
And she says because she was never allowed to defend herself when she wanted to, that several things surrounding her turned into much bigger scandals. Carroll says she feels these events occurred because Scott and his staff may have already found out that she was planning to leave and not be his running mate again.
I was not happy in the job. I was not happy by the way I was being treated by his staff. And I was not happy that I was not getting his support for, number one, for the work that I was doing, appreciation for that. Number two, how he was allowing his staff to mistreat me. And so I was already geared to not be on the ticket. I was, as a matter of fact, the day that I resigned from office was the day that I received my final resume, which I was having redone and updated so that I can look into the private sector for work.
So what's next for Carroll?
I'm looking at writing another book, actually a couple books, one on parenting and another one on women in their life and having it all, having it most.
She says for now she'll continue to promote her book. She's also been helping other politicians in their races. In addition, Carroll is a political commentator for WJXT Channel 4, a Jacksonville TV station. And she says for that reason, she won't be stating who she's voting for in the upcoming gubernatorial race. Meanwhile, following the release of the book, both Scott and his office have reiterated that, quote, Carroll made the right decision for her family by resigning, and they appreciate her service. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Florida Public Radio's Jessica Palumbo joins us now. This is a big week for new laws, Jessica. 32 new statutes have hit the Florida law books this week, and you've been keeping track of exactly what they are. What are some of the highlights of the big 32 that we now have to worry about breaking?
Okay, Tom. Well, certainly the law that faced the biggest opposition back when it was attempted in the legislature is called the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. That's the one that now makes it a separate crime if you harm a woman and hurt or kill her unborn baby in the act. It's been filed every year for almost a decade, and in recent years, there was a case that was held up as the poster case for why this was needed. That was a Tampa woman whose boyfriend purposely gave her a drug in an attempt to make her miscarry. It's a drug called Cytosec that's normally used to treat stomach ulcers, but it can cause miscarriage and birth defects in pregnant women. The woman in that case testified to the House Judiciary Committee and eventually won enough sympathy to get that bill passed. Of course, several lawmakers objected to it on the grounds that it could cause confusion in cases of unintended harm like car accidents, and by defining unborn children as people for this purpose could lead to more restrictive reproductive rights down the road.
For the past several years, there has been an increasing focus on human trafficking here in Florida, since we are one of the national hotbeds of that kind of activity. Anything new kicking in relative to that, Jessica?
Yes, a law now on the books more harshly punishes human trafficking, and it has some parts in there to help victims recover as well. Maybe the biggest change now is that there's no statute of limitations on these types of crimes, so no matter how long ago you were victimized in Florida, your abuser can now be punished and you can be compensated potentially. It's now a first-degree felony to profit from trafficking children. And a relatively minor change that's also in that law applies to adult movie theaters. It calls for them to do background checks and ensure that they're not hiring minors. Related to that is also another package of laws that's aimed at more harshly punishing sex offenders, and that adds some registration and monitoring requirements for them as well.
Back during the legislative session and even before then, there was this issue of unregulated parasail operators in Florida on both the Atlantic and the Gulf Coast, and some legislation came down. What's the details of that, Jessica?
The changes now in effect were spurred by some really horrific deaths and injuries, most notably recently here in Panama City Beach. Two Indiana teenagers were very seriously injured. So now parasail companies are required to monitor the weather and halt their operations if it gets too windy, and it requires an amount of insurance for them too.
Any other laws that we might have to worry about here, Jessica?
Yeah, Tom, if you are planning to burgle some houses, a word of caution if you're planning to travel to do that. Now there are increased penalties for crossing county lines to do that crime, so just keep it in your neighborhood.
Yes. Attention, burglars. Stay within your home county, and you'll still get busted and go to jail, but the penalties won't be quite as severe. All of these new Florida statutes taking effect as of October 1st. Florida Public Radio's Jessica Palumbo bringing us up to date. Thanks, Jessica.
Thanks, Tom.
Elmira Mangum's inauguration as Florida A&M University's 11th president capped off a week of celebrating what the school is calling a new season. As Donald Debevoise reports, speakers from FAMU and across the nation praised Mangum and her vision for the school during today's ceremonies.
Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you the 11th president of Florida Agricultural and Mechanical University.
A crowd of FAMU students, professors, graduates, and trustees cheers as Trustee Chair Solomon Badger presents the University Mace, a ceremonial staff decorated in school colors, to Elmira Mangum, signifying her acceptance of the position as the school's head. Mangum says she's excited for the position.
It's a true honor to stand here and accept this responsibility to preserve the legacy of open doors to an accessible and affordable education that embraces the needs of today and tomorrow. As the 11th president, I am committed to this challenge.
Friday not only marks the beginning of Mangum's presidential term, but it's also FAMU's Founders Day, a celebration of the school's past leaders and its creation. Guest speaker Mary Bro Wright praised Mangum for her role as the school's first female president and for what she's already accomplished since taking the reins.
Since her arrival, FAMU has tackled several issues facing the university and will face many more. But let me tell you, a woman is like a tea bag. You never know how strong she is until you put her in hot water.
But Mangum says FAMU has reached a turning point in its history for other reasons.
It's a new season because it's a time of change and transition. It's the beginning of a recovery and a renewal and of all that is great about FAMU.
Mangum used the celebration week to highlight major priorities in her vision for the school, like community service, civil engagement, and environmental sustainability. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Donald Debevoise.
You're listening to Capitol Report on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, time was only a few generations ago, most of America's jobs involved manual labor of some kind, often in a big factory. But in the past few decades, technology has pushed many of America's blue-collar jobs away from heavy industry and towards skilled trades. Nick Evans reports North Florida Community College is hoping a new program will prepare its students for these jobs of the future.
That's North Florida Community College's 3D printer humming along on a project. It's sitting in the college's brand new automation and production technology lab.
There's 10 stations throughout the room. Each one of the stations has got various activities that will involve the students with hands-on. The first section is tolerance and quality control.
That's Bill Eustace. He's the instructor for the new program. The idea is to prepare students for manufacturing jobs that have become increasingly dependent on automatic and programmable technologies. NFCC is focused on putting its students face-to-face with the same machines they'll use professionally. One of them is a programmable logic controller, or PLC. Eustace says they have a variety of uses in an industrial setting.
The PLC is basically a control switch, tells something to do something. It could be a gate that opens up. It could be a different conveyor system that turns on. Several different functions of a PLC.
The workshop has two computer numeric control, or CNC, machines for crafting parts based on a computer model. There's even a small FANUC robot. It's one of those arm-like machines you see building cars in commercials. Another station has a hydraulic controller.
Let's let this power up. It's been sitting all weekend. There's your pump on.
And this brings up the other goal of the program.
This would be, a lot of students around this area are going to be introduced to this at a very young age, because a lot of the equipment off tractors and things like that for Daddy's farm runs off of hydraulics. So bucket loaders, front-end loaders, things of that nature.
The NFCC is in Madison, a rural city about 50 miles east of Tallahassee. As the economy has made this shift toward automation and manufacturing, the brunt of that change has fallen on rural areas. For instance, in 2006, a Smithfield meat packaging facility based in Madison closed. Nearly 500 people lost their jobs, and for scale, 2010 U.S. Census figures put Madison's entire population at less than 3,000. The new program is part of an effort by the U.S. Departments of Labor and Education to support these communities. The grant will help fund the program through 2017, and the college will take over from there. David Dunkel oversees the school's efforts in career technical education, and he's excited about how fast students will see results.
There's a lot of, Bill had mentioned earlier, Nestle, Snyder's-Lance, Chemring Ordnance is another company in Perry, Georgia-Pacific, Foley Cellulose, they just recently awarded a $900 scholarship. So there are companies in the area, and statewide, advanced manufacturing is on the rise.
And Dunkel says local businesses need employees with the skills students will gain in the automation program.
It's only an 18-week course, so in less than 6 months, somebody can have the hands-on experience, they'll have the industry credentials to go right into work, so you don't have to go to school for 4 years to make decent money.
NFCC officials say they're expecting between 20 and 25 students for their first term. Classes will begin early next year. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Nick Evans, and Jessica Palumbo. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations, along with Donald Debevoise. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust. Empowerment. Education. Employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.